Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 41 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. We got several pictures from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. We got a picture of Claire having what looks like concealer painted on her neck. She looks very happy. Mm-hmm. We got... I don't even want to talk about this picture. I don't even think I can talk about this picture without...
Summer is going to go...
Bill, that's what my insides are doing right
that's
now.
That's true. I heard it.
Anyway. Okay, so they also had a picture of Sam Heughan with his clavicles hanging out. And
he had...
with his clavicles hanging out.
Yes, I was starting a little bit higher. He has, looks like he has a blowout.
A Scottish
but
blowout.
Who sees the hair and you see the clavs?
I couldn't see his hair at all.
Me either. I just saw the V.
Draped with this, like a deep V-neck. They nice probably had to cut it that deep so I could get it over that giant head of hair he's got.
Wait, someone referred... After this came out, someone referred to something Sam had tweeted about his having cleavage. And I thought that was just inappropriate or odd or whatever, but... Hello Kitty.
Seriously, if
he has
I
a little bit of cleavage.
If I had that specific shirt on, that would be down to my navel. I'm just saying, I don't have the clavicles to hold that up.
Oh my gosh, I mean, that was
sweet
a
Lord.
Nice.
I mean, I didn't even take time to look at his face. I'm not even gonna lie.
His face
until
is
you noticed,
nice.
Until you mentioned his hair, I didn't even look up past the top of that V-neck.
Mm-hmm. I can't
that,
even.
That muscle was that like a Scottish euphemism?
Mm-hmm. No, he has put on...
He's bulked up.
Jamie
he
White.
He is definitely bulked
he's
up.
He's bulked up. And he's not a Hulk monster, but he is...
No, it's nice
he's
and
appropriately,
Jamie.
He is appropriately...
Jamie.
Bulked up. Yes. But you can tell not only in his body, but in his face. I mean, look at that jaw. His face is wider now.
I feel really bad right now that we literally said one thing about Katrina's picture, and we've been going on for like 5 minutes
Isn't
about...
that awful?
So, Showcase posted the new premiere date for Outlander in Canada, which will be August 24th.
A Sunday.
Oh, they're going to have it on Sundays.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I never thought about the Sunday part of it. I was always thinking about the date.
Hmm.
Outlander also released a new trailer. This is the longest one yet. Now, this has also got some little behind-the-scenes footage
yeah.
and stuff.
Not just the trailer, yeah.
But still, there was new footage in it
yes,
that I was very excited.
And
this
was
this.
First shown at the retreat.
I mean, I'll have to take your word for it.
No, it was. And then they...
I was not at the retreat. I stayed
first,
home.
It was first shown at the retreat, and then it was, as we presumed it was going to be at some point, they made it pretty quickly. It was available to all. Was it Saturday or Sunday? This was yesterday.
Ooh,
I
yesterday.
Think it was Saturday. Yeah, so it was gorgeous and...
Did you watch it on a big screen?
Yes, huge.
Like an IMAX screen?
Oh, yeah. No, they did not
they
wheel
didn't
in
cart
the
IMAX.
No, it was a big screen, though. I mean, a big enough screen.
Like a projection screen.
Pretty much, but a good size one. There were two projection screens in the room.
Like, were the people life-size on the screen?
I think so.
Like if you were standing next.
Probably bigger.
Bigger?
Bigger heads, mm-hmm. yeah. But a beautiful one.
Now, this came out this week, this next little tidbit, and it says, Xbox One fans, get ready to play. Stars Play is going to be coming to the Xbox, which is great and all, but you will still need to have a subscription to Stars. So,
yes.
it's neat that there'll be another way to access your Stars mm-hmm. stuff, but I mean, you're still going to have a...
But it is nice. They're starting to...
No, for sure.
And as someone...
Because I know HBO Go is on Xbox.
Yeah.
Diana posted some pictures this week of... She was, like, in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
A little traveling before her very busy week, her busy schedule starts up, you know, with the book coming out and all of the little... book signing she's going to in this next week. This is going to be a busy week for her. And it started, I think it started with the retreat.
She went down on Thursday or maybe Friday. I think she, no, because someone had tweeted that they had run into her Friday morning at the airport. So she traveled to, she may have had something else before that we don't know about, but she traveled to Seattle.
She could have been signing all those books, you don't know.
She signed them all when she got to Seattle.
That's what I'm saying. So she got in a day early to sign all those books.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. But I'm saying she wasn't doing anything that we know of that's been told to us before Friday. Because Friday morning is when people ran into her at the airport, and she signed all those things, and Saturday was a retreat. But yeah, so she was sharing a little bit before a number of things go on.
And then the pictures from the retreat started coming out.
From the what?
The retreat. I'm tired.
I'm tired. It's hard to say. I'm tired.
It's tired. I'm tired.
It's tired.
Not only that, but I'm just going to point out that we had to turn the air conditioning off and the fans off for two reasons. One, you can pick it up in the microphones. Second of all, there's a skunk in the neighborhood and it's coming in.
It's not a pretty smell.
It's not okay. So I'm a little loopy tonight from the stench in my house.
And the heat.
And the heat. So, the Outlander retreat photos have been leaking out all, pretty much since the beginning of Saturday.
Since it started, yeah.
They've been all over the place. As our eyes on the ground, I would like to introduce to you.
Introduce to you?
Introduce to you, Ginger, to tell us a little bit about the Seattle retreat experience.
Because you've never met me before, listeners.
Because I was not there. So, I will allow her
a few
to illuminate you.
Okay, so after getting there and registering and kind of finding a seat and finding your way around and looking at the schedule, basically what many of you, hopefully most of you, saw was the keynote with Diana. And then we had a little bit of a break and they had a performance improv comedy troupe perform. I got some pictures of them. They were very entertaining. And then lunch at your leisure. But then they had some Scottish dancing. And then I was able to kind of pop in and get a quick few pictures of Teresa with Outlander Kitchen doing a little kind of a presentation. She was showing off her books and I think a number of books were given away. There was like a little contest and it was, I think it's called A Taste of Outlander. It's beautiful. Besides Diana, which we all looked forward to, there was the making of Outlander with Diana, first of all, reps from Stars and Random House. And I know I didn't get all of the names, but there was also someone from, I believe, The Poison Pen in Arizona. And they talked, it was so interesting, because yes, we were all looking forward, I know, to hear from Stars and hear, see whatever they were going to share. But a number of weeks ago or months ago, Random House asked attendees to send in a 30-second video. And that they were going to do something special with it. Many, many people did. And it was so sweet. And it was so thoughtful of them to offer that. And they put them all together with some music. And it was very nice to see. And just some people, some of the things that were shared just brought tears to your eyes. People were saying how much they enjoyed Diana, how they came to the books, what it meant to them, basically. It was very sweet. It was very nice that Random House did that. And, of course, then the pièce de résistance besides Diana, of course, was the Stars, whatever they were going to show. We saw the extended promo, which we just mentioned earlier. And then there was a little bit more. And, well, at the fan event, we had no clue they were going to play it twice. So I was busy watching everything. I did not take notes. So, unfortunately, we only saw it once. But the second thing they played was slightly different, had a few similar things, but one of the things that has been remarked on several blog posts I've read that was the thing that will stick with me the most is there was a scene, a flash of a scene with Claire and Jamie on a horse coming up to Dougal on a horse. And Dougal and Jamie were speaking Gaelic to each other, and Claire was kind of lost. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is immersion. This is the, oh my gosh, it was too much. That gave me shivers. I'm telling you, this, we already know this, but it's going to be pretty awesome. And of course, sprinkled throughout the day, people had a chance to go have their book signed with Diana. I did that. And there was a mixer afterwards. I was able to chat with people from Stars and Random House, and I was able to talk to a good number of other fans, and it was just very, very exciting, and I appreciate that opportunity. I know all the people who were there did as well, and the Outlander community is just amazing. Unbelievable. Gracious hosts, very generous. Thank you, everyone who
had a hand in that.
And we also got a new little video, a little 2-minute video from Pop Sugar from the set of Outlander, which was a nice little, like, sort of featurette, a little 2-minute featurette. That it had most of the stuff we've already seen, but, you know.
Lotta was in it. She talked a bit.
Yes.
But that is about it. It was a very busy week. There's a lot of good stuff as we get closer and closer to the release of the series. I think we're just getting more and more great footage out, more and more great articles. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting noticed more, you guys.
So this week for our read-along, Chapter 37, Escape. We have Dave Weinsock here again with us, who we interviewed a number of weeks ago, and he has kept his word and is joining us for a read-along.
No,
and
we are kept his word and read the book.
Oh, that's true.
And joining us for a read-along.
He finished quickly, though.
I went so, very, very quickly. Yeah, how can you not go through it quickly, though? I mean, it just...
Seriously, I know. I have read a lot of people say that they stopped after a chapter or two because it kind of dragged. Now, I don't, having read it a number of times, I don't find that any of it drags, but I have anticipation getting to the point where I know things start. So it's never a drag for me, but I can see how it's not very fast moving in the first two paragraphs. Excuse me.
Well, yeah, the first two paragraphs.
I'm really judgy, aren't I? The first two chapters.
Well, it's got to set the scene, you know? I mean, it's creating the atmosphere. And, you know, of course, having experienced some of the places that they're describing in the first few chapters, I'm able to relate to it. And I think even for people who haven't firsthand been to a stone circle or been to a small highland village or anything like that, you know, it's painting this overall picture of what you're going to be catching ahead. So is there a bunch of action, you know? Is there some of the romance that there is to sort of later on? Not to the same degree, but, you know, you've got to start somewhere before you get too far into the thick of it.
I mean, there's a level of exposition required with pretty much every book.
And the good thing about, and we talked about this throughout so many different episodes, we've mentioned the whole thing about, you know, translating different things to screen. Almost every chapter or set of chapters we do a read-along for, I will bring something up, and some are as well, of, oh, I wonder how they'll do X, Y, Z, and, or this may be difficult to translate, or this may not to screen. I know that's part of the discussion, kind of part of what we started this entire podcast to do, was just so we had a place for ourselves to chat about things. But I agree, and I'm glad you brought up, both of you, the setting the scene and the exposition, because the necessary thing with video or with TV is your limited time. So you have to get things going pretty soon. Well, we already know from the clip of the page of the first episode that episode one is called Sethnach, which means something happens in the first episode.
Yes.
So, number one, they have to grab people, right? And number two, the good thing is with the visual medium is that you can do all this flashback and juxtaposition, and you can go back and forth to the 1700s to the 1900s and show Frank searching for her or her looking for this and that. So the cool thing is you don't need such an exposition in the video.
Of course, but you can also do like 3 or 4 pages of exposition in like
a minute. Exactly.
Barely a minute. You could do it with like one scene where you can see how the light is hitting things, and you could see the trees, and you could see all the things. And all those things that Diana would take 3 pages to describe, you could
very
see
beautifully,
instantly.
But yes.
Yeah. Well, they say, you know, of course, classically, that a picture says 1,000 words, right? So imagine you know, an episode of a television show or a film can do in terms of how many pages that's covering. I mean, if you look at a book like Lord of the Rings, for instance, I mean, Tolkien can spend 5 pages just describing the way the sun glints off the grass in a field.
And, you know, exactly. Yeah.
But, you know, thankfully, they accelerate that in the films. One of the things I'm looking forward to, though, with the Outlander TV series is how they create that atmosphere without charging too quickly ahead. Because I think even in the first few moments of the book, there are some really beautiful scenes. You do get a sense of how loving and intimate, if somewhat troubled, Frank and Claire's relationship is. And I don't know about you, but when I'm reading a book, I'm sort of creating a film in my head.
All right.
What I think the book is trying to convey. So I've already got some idea of the sort of shots they might take and positioning of the characters and the lighting. I'm always interested to see how that internal movie matches up to what actually ends up on screen.
Very much so, and I think you're exactly correct. Another reason it can't be too rushed, even though, yes, you can do a lot of flashbacks, one of the things that they, I believe, will have to show, because it's alluded to, and we just a few weeks ago did the chapter 34, I think, when or 33 or 34, when she and Myrta are looking for Jamie, and they're going around and they meet the gypsies, and they're going from town to town, actually, before they meet the gypsies. And one of the things she does is he sings, and she kind of sings with him, but she is doing the palm reading. And she learns this skill quite quickly in a one-time session from Mrs. Graham. Mm-hmm. So they have to spend some time on these things that she may well flash back to, or they may well show it, go back to that scene to remind us, oh yeah, she learned that. Certain things, I agree, that they likely will do or will have to do so that the audience, if she at least refers to, I had learned that with Mrs. Graham, it looks like I'm going to be able to put this to the test now.
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to have to set the tone. Judging from some of the images that have come out and the previews, it does seem to be quite atmospheric. I mean, some of the shots, especially of Castle Leoch, for instance, are just absolutely stunning. So I think, again, there's so many ways that they can set these sort of things up and revisit them over and over again through the medium of video that perhaps it is a bit more difficult to convey in the written word. Just like you say, you know, when Claire is reminiscing about Frank, wondering, you know, what he's doing without her, they can quite easily go back to the 20th century, to Frank's world, and show what's happening rather than just having her speculate. So, you know, it may be the case that we actually get to see some of her internal monologues fleshed out a bit more than they actually were in the book to a certain extent.
They're going to have to, or else half of the thing will be voiceover with her just right. standing there off in the distance. Having an inner monologue.
This is quite a few weeks ago now, but I think Summer and I talked about it. I'm thrilled with the fact that they kept the first words of the first book, which are not by Claire. They're read, on the audiobook, they're read by a gentleman, but they actually are before chapter one starts. And I don't even know if it's the prologue. It's just like literally a paragraph or two or three about people disappear all the time. And there's usually an explanation for it, or they're usually found most of the time. When I heard that from that disappearance trailer, I was tickled.
I'm getting goosebumps all over again.
I'm sorry. I was so tickled that they would have her say that, because that's crazy.
Yeah, I've actually got it right in front of me. I've got a call.
Oh, you do? Of course you do.
I do my research. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. You are a researcher.
And it's, of course, called Cross Stitch over here. Rather.
Yes, that's, yes.
Yeah, but it was an interesting start to the book. I wasn't quite expecting it. It made it almost sound like an investigative mystery.
Yeah, I agree.
So it gave it a little bit of a sinister tone.
For people who haven't read the book, when I introduce people to the books, I always tell them, you just have to at least get through the stones. If you get through the stones, I promise you'll be swept away in the story. And I feel like that's kind of how they have to do the first episode.
Oh, yeah.
They have to get her through the stones.
Yeah.
I think people will still be interested, because I know that for me, the 1940s was not as interesting, because I really wanted her to get back in time. And I think that they don't sweep her back through the stones in the first episode. I think that they'll be missing out on a great opportunity to get people really hooked. But I'm sure they have to.
To me, yes. The need is there. Number two, the title is Sassenach. She's not a Sassenach. Well, technically she's a Sassenach, I guess, in Scotland in the 1940s.
Yep. Yeah.
Technically, but really, for real, she's a Sassenach in the 1700s. And when, not just because of the title, that was number two, but also because it wouldn't really, if she, whatever magic they do, if she goes to the stones and does that quick, you know, oh my gosh, where am I, what happened kind of thing, and then it ends, I mean, I could kind of maybe see that, but I think my guess is that they would end it after she's come across a few things. Like, we know from the trailer that they don't show anything with Randall, but we know that from the books, Randall kisses her, comes up against her, all that. We know that she's rescued by the Scots or kidnapped by the Scots, but, you know, that may not be in the first episode. It may just be her getting through, and then what the heck, what's going on? There's a war, people, you know, screaming and crying and Gaelic and guns and what's going on.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that should be the title. Gaelic and guns and what's going on.
Yeah, you've got your title.
I think we found our title.
Gaelic and guns and what's
going on. They're going to have to go past a certain tipping point, that's for sure. I could see it happening where, you know, she has the encounter with Blackjack Randall, and then they're marching or riding through the night, and then there's that encounter, the skirmish at the rocks. I could almost see the lull right before that being the point at which they break it off, because then you're established period. You're not 100% sure as to what quite is going on yet, where exactly you are, when exactly you are, but something is definitely different. And it would give enough of a taste of that to get people hooked, I think, without giving away too much of what is yet to come. So in my mind, that's sort of the perfect break-off point.
I think so. I think there are any number of ways they could end number one, episode one, and still make it kind of have a little bit of a, not a cliffhanger, but a mini cliffhanger, you know, like people wanting to obviously tune back in, which I don't think we'll have a problem with, but I'm very biased, so oh. I can't say
apparently the music alone.
Oh my Lord. Can you just stop it?
Yeah, what Diana says.
So many people on Twitter were saying, oh my gosh, I have to make sure, or thank goodness I have surround sound. This is going to be amazing. So Diana is in love with the music, and it's, oh my gosh.
Music is really important.
Of course it is.
Setting a scene.
Hold on. Okay, back up. The same, I don't know if it was, I guess it was the same, the Disappearance trailer, right? When it was released for the U.S., it had that song, My Love is a Jungle, or something about a jungle in the background, or Your Love is a Jungle. It was very kind of, well, it was very kind of, it was a little, not quite rocky, but it was a little hardcore towards the end. But then if you listen to or watched, but if you watch the same exact trailer, someone said that there may have been a difference. I didn't really see it, but I could have missed anything. The exact same trailer had different background music, not from Bear McCreary, but different music was chosen for the background. Same exact trailer. It comes off as so different. The first one was a very, with the music and with a lot of Claire and this and that. People say it's very much, not weepy, but very much about Claire and kind of sad, a little bit more emotional. But then the other cut, say, or I think the same cut, but different music, was much more of a kind of a mystery thing. So it so much sets the tone for how people approach these.
Well, I mean, have you seen those trailers that they do online where they do alternate trailers where they go on and mess with the music and they make, like, The Shining sound like a Disney movie?
No.
Or, like, so they'll change just, like, the music and then what the voiceover says. And just how they edit the trailer can change the entire scene of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if they had done the trailer with, like, Benny Hill music or, like, something ridiculous, it would have totally made it look like a comedy. So music is very important.
Absolutely.
And there's such a wealth of really brilliant music to draw from that I think would sync up so well with the feel that they're trying to go for. That's one of the things I'm really excited about. I mean, soundtracks really stay with me, and I think they stay with a lot of people, especially for period pieces. You know, it can have such a dramatic effect on just how you feel coming away from it. So I think we're going to get some pretty iconic music coming out of this. I mean, because they've got this fantastic opportunity to blend modern music, which is a bit more almost rocky, as you say, with some of the more traditional music of the Isles and the Highlands. And I hear that every day in the streets of Edinburgh. I mean, there are pipers who play modern songs, for instance, on their pipes, or who reinterpret the old Gaelic tunes. And it's an incredible experience. And I just think there's such a wealth of things that they'll be able to mine. I don't think we'll have any shortage of songs to hum along to well after the episodes have ended.
You said something that I had not thought of. I had thought of Scottish or folk music, traditional music, of course. And I had thought of, you know, 40s music or something from the early 20th century. But I was thinking within their own time frame. So when they're in the 40s or having any flashbacks or flash forwards, whatever you want to call them, it would be not inappropriate to have that type of music if it's that atmosphere. And then back in the 1700s to have more traditional music. However, you're exactly right. This is a very unique opportunity for Bear. It does not have to be 100% reflective of traditional music, which is exciting. I never considered that. I thought once they're back in the 18th century, it has to be very traditional. But here, the whole thing of, and this is, shows how much inside the box I tend to think, you have this displaced woman outside of her own time. So it only makes sense that that be reflected in the music. I love that.
Maybe we'll see some of it.
Why are you laughing at me?
No.
I never thought of the music.
Burst into a flurry of activity.
It's all Dave's fault. He mentioned it first.
So speaking of Dave,
oh,
what's
yeah.
been going on? I know that Bannockburn, the thing oh. that you work at, has been like exploding. I'm seeing
yeah.
it everywhere now.
It's everywhere.
It does seem to be everywhere. I'm still getting used to the idea of seeing my mug on promotional videos and hearing radio interviews and all this sort of stuff. It's all very exciting. I mean, people are getting into the rhythm of it now, and word has got around about the kind of experience that it offers. So we're jam-packed from morning until closing time. So people are having a lot of fun with it, and of course, we're gearing up for the big Bannockburn weekend, Bannockburn Live. And recently, I actually had the privilege to attend a screening of a new documentary about the Battle of Bannockburn, which is going to be premiering on the BBC on the 2nd and 9th of June in two parts. And there's some really exciting developments that are going to change our understanding of the battle, and it's beautifully shot. So that, along with the launch of Bannockburn Live, I think all eyes are going to be on Bannockburn in the coming weeks, as I think they should be, because it's a absolutely pivotal moment in Scottish history. And a lot of people, again, are trying to tie it into the independence debate, but really it has nothing to do with that. This would be a massive celebration and a massive reflection on the 700th anniversary of the battle, whether or not that was happening. So it's a tremendously exciting time to be involved in a project like that. And it is just full tilt now. We've got the Clan Ranald Trust for Scotland as well hanging around quite a bit, and they're in full costume, which is quite exciting because you'll be walking down the hall and all of a sudden you'll see a man in a full plaid and kilt with a broadsword slung across his back. And yeah, if you ever start forgetting where you are, that brings you firmly back into place.
Congratulations to you and your part in this. We're so happy and excited for all of that, and wish we could be there this summer.
Great. Well, I think a few of the Outlander fans are going to be coming along to Bannockburn Live, actually. Can give a little shout out to Michelle Lawless, who is in talks with Malin from the Clan Ranald Trust, and she's going to be coming along. We've been chatting a little bit on Twitter, and so I know she'll be here on the battlefield at Bannockburn Live. So there are going to be some Outlanders and hooligans making their way to Bannockburn.
Very cool. The real reason you're here is to help us with our read-along.
Yes.
Now, thankfully, although 36 wasn't, I guess, so bad, 35 was another.
That was so long.
So long of a chapter. But so 36 was not so bad, but 37 was pretty nice and not short, but shorter.
It's compact, but there's still...
Very compact. Oh my gosh, so much. But for me, the witch trial sequence gets it in and is just, I never stopped. And that's what someone I said. That's the point where we're up all night reading and we can't put it down.
It was the exact same with me. I've got an hour ride into Stirling every day, one way from Edinburgh. And so once I got to around that point, all I did was cycle over to the bus station, get on the bus, put my stuff down, crack open the book, start reading up until the second that the bus pulled into my stop, go fight a few battles, get on my lunch break, heat up something in 5 minutes flat, sit down, get the book out in front of me, and that was pretty much my day for 2 days straight, and absolutely tortured.
Jamie has been rescued from Wentworth, but not, of course, before being tortured and raped by Captain Randall. Claire and Lady McGranagh have helped tend to his physical wounds, though we know his emotional wounds will be much longer in healing. So when asked by Claire how he feels, Jamie answers, "Sassenach, if I've got one, it hurts."
That's a great line.
It is. And he has a lot. I mean, Jamie always has a lot of good lines, but this chapter had a good few, a good number of lines that made me giggle. They have to make their escape. As we said, they've already done some escapes, but yet again, they have to make their escape, this time from the soldiers that are surely searching from Wentworth, on the lookout for them. Myrta and Jamie are on horses, with weapons, tons of weapons beneath their cloaks, whatever they could carry. And Claire only has her dagger, also on a horse. And she's told that she is to pose as an English hostage, should worse come to worse. And before they leave, Sir Marcus and Claire had padded Jamie's hips and thighs as thickly as possible with linen under his dark-colored breeches, so that in case the blood was seeping through, it, of course, wouldn't show up, and to sop it up. And he also wore a shirt that was split for him, but even split, it still wouldn't meet in front over his large size. And his hair, I hope they do his hair all funky, but his hair was sticking straight up every which way, and he didn't want it combed. He said even his head hurt, or his head hurt too much. And they had to cover it, obviously, because of the color. Sir Marcus tells Claire that if she's taken, she is to say that she's a guest of his, kidnapped while near the estate, and to bring her to Eldridge, to tell the soldiers to bring her to Eldridge for him to identify. And she'll say that she's a friend of Annabelle's, his wife's. from London. And then after the soldiers go to get whomever needs to go to bring back to identify her officially, she'll take off like a bat out of hell and get away herself.
Well,
and
it's still a very precarious position that they're
in. Oh, gosh. The whole thing. Them out together, 100%. Even if they get lost and she's by herself, of course, it never, it's just, there's no way she's still in trouble. Absolutely. Let's go in that direction for a moment. Let's say, God forbid, they were found or arrested and she was able to get away and go back, taken back to the estate and then got away as they had just said. Do you guys think that at her earliest convenience, she'd be going back to those stones?
I think that as long as Jamie is alive, she's staying.
Well, okay. She finds out, if those guys are taken in, they're not going to get another chance to get out. If Murta and Jamie are captured, they're going to be hung or killed some other way.
Probably immediately.
Probably immediately, if not later on, yeah.
Well, I don't think they would allow themselves to be taken alive at this point.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I mean, there was a big risk when they do encounter the four soldiers,
yeah.
You know, where Jamie draws his gun and fires. Being in the state that he was in, he certainly wasn't up for much of a fight. So that right there, I think, tells you that for him it was a matter of either we're killing these men or they're killing us.
Whether he's killed before he goes in, which I think he would prefer if he had to have one of those, he doesn't want to be taken alive, then the question still stands. Do both of you or either of you think that Claire would, at her earliest, safest convenience, get back to those stones?
I think it would be likely to happen if Jamie was absolutely 100% known to be dead.
I thought you were going to say if he was absolutely 100% dead. I'm like, we're not talking the Princess Bride here. We're all there's only dead.
He's mostly dead all day.
Right. True babe.
Because I think, you know, she has begun to certainly settle into life in the 18th century, and she got some sense of normalcy and feeling at home when they were in Lallybroch, and that's one of the things that makes this so torturous from the reader's perspective, is it seemed like things were finally going according to plan, like they'd be able to settle down, and then they get caught up in the situation yet again. So I don't know that her connection to this world without Jamie in it is quite strong enough for her to wholly abandon the one that she already knows. I think if she were to go back, it would be very much like a veteran of war who had been in the theater for years upon years and has gotten used to one way of life, going back into something that's familiar but somehow now quite alien. So I think she would go back, but she would almost be like an outcast in her own time at that point. So I don't think it would be easy going for her either way.
Oh, I definitely agree. I think something that may, of course, if they had been together longer before something like that had happened, which never happened in the book. I think exactly that. Her ties were 100% to Jamie, and that was why she decided to stay. Spent almost 6 months trying to get back, so we know she was trying to get back. But it was finally she made her decision. But I think with him gone, other than maybe, you know, making sure she brought whatever his effects were to Lallybroch, and maybe to say goodbye to Jenny and them and let them know, because they had a right to know what happened.
Absolutely.
But other than that, I mean, she had no need to go to Lioch again. That was bad. Yeah, I think other than that, I think I would have gone back.
Well, if you look at it, she really, between the two time periods, she really has the one common denominator is her only real connection is a person.
Mm-hmm.
So, because she doesn't have an extended family, she doesn't have, you know, a bunch of roots dug down on either side. So the only thing she had in the 40s was Frank. And the only thing she had in the 1740s was Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
And she obviously chose Jamie over Frank. So at this point, if she lost, the only reason that she stayed in the 40s, there would be no reason for her to stay. I mean, the 1740s is the only reason for her to stay. Then I don't see.
And as you said in the podcast for chapter 24, she does have a habit of lamenting the comforts of the 20th century. So I think that...
Yes. Oh, girlfriend would not be mad to be back for that reason.
Yeah. Hot bath.
Yeah. Okay. So, three are on horses. Three, yeah, they're on one horse. No, they're on horses, and they're on the road to Dingwall.
Yes, yeah, Dingwall.
Claire had a fat purse with a note from Master of Eldridge. A combination, or even individually, should have covered their passage across the channel. They each were on their own horse, as I said, and Jamie rode alone, but he was tied to his horse, and that was by his insistence. Tied...
I should hope so. I don't think he could stay on that horse by himself after what he's been through.
And his bad hand, I'm guessing, is probably, hopefully by the wrist or by some more solid piece. His hand or his arm is somehow tied to himself or to the horse or pommel. Or what? That's, we have to ask Lene about saddle design. I don't know if they had pommels back then. Pommels are specifically Western, no?
Oh, Western. I think Australian saddles also have them.
Yeah, but not English.
No, English. But, you know, if you look, like, English side
saddles. There may
be
something
had...
there. Oh, well, I don't think they gave her a side saddle.
Oh, she was not in the side saddle. And they would not have put Jamie on a side saddle.
Oh, of course
saying.
Not.
Jamie wouldn't have allowed himself to be put in the side saddle.
Exactly. So he is tied and made stable on his horse with his hand resting on the pistol, all hidden under his cloak. He and Murtaugh have these big cloaks.
Well, think
on.
About it. He has to be tied to
well,
it.
Well, and he's got to be covered.
He can only... hold that pistol with one of his hands. The other hand is
I don't even
mangled.
Know if he's holding it. Is his hand
to...
is resting on it. Oh, okay.
He
has to hold
it
up to shoot it.
Oh, my God.
No, not while he's riding. He can put his hand on it, but he has to hold it up to shoot, unless he has it aimed or something.
Well, my point is with his good hand on the pistol, his bad hand can't hold onto the saddle.
What she said was his left hand was free to reach the pistol.
Okay.
So I guess it wasn't resting on it. But it was free to get to it. So they rode by Wentworth Castle, and Diana's words are something like, in the shadow of the castle. So it's now it's called a castle. Is it separate from
the prison?
Or does the prison just... I'm guessing it's a former castle. It's still a castle, but not used
well,
as
our,
such.
Our castle gentleman here might know.
Oh, yes. Well, but it's, it's a
fictitious place. I'm looking at my version here, and I know there are some small differences between the version printed in the UK and in the States. It says, 2 miles from Eldridge, we passed under the shadow of Wentworth Prison, a grim bulk set in the hillside.
That's so funny.
Now, with Wentworth Prison, you know, as I mentioned in the article that I did for you guys a few months back, it wouldn't have been a castle per se. It would have been much more like a semi-modern barracks hall, really. So there were four of these barracks built throughout the Highlands following the 1715-16 Jacobite Rebellion. One of them was quite close to Inverness, about 40 miles south of it, at a place called Ruthven Barracks. There was another one over at Inverlochy by modern Fort William, and two others scattered throughout the Highlands. And these are places which are usually built on high bits of ground, on earthen mounds. They would have a small wall, but nothing like the kind of towering curtain wall that you would expect to see at a medieval castle, for instance, at a place like Doon Castle, which is the shooting location for Castle Leoch. And it would have been very much about function rather than luxury or a sort of noble residence, which castles very much were. I mean, castles were defensible, but first and foremost, they were the homes of nobles or of powerful lords. So they would really have only had a barracks hall, a place for the soldiers to sleep, a courtyard for them to do some drills in, a small prison, as well as usually an officer's quarters. Some of them would be larger than others. Wentworth sounds like it was quite expansive. So it would be closer in size, for instance, to the one over at Inverlochy rather than the one at Ruthven. So Wentworth Prison seems to be an amalgamation of some of these different post-15 Jacobite Rebellion fortifications, really. So think of them as pretty similar to a modern military barracks hall with place for the soldiers to sleep, do a little bit of recreation, a courtyard for drilling, and that was about it. These were places that were all about pacifying the area around them. They were not built for comfort. They were built for the suppression of the local population.
You know, it's funny. We just looked at our copy of the book, and maybe it's a typo on our end, but ours actually does say Wentworth Castle.
I typed it. I didn't make it up.
That's so weird.
And
it must
never
be a typo.
But it's not called a castle before then.
No.
It's called prison.
Which is why I'm calling it a typo.
Okay. I didn't assume, but I was curious to see if indeed there was an actual historical Wentworth, and I couldn't find anything of that name in Scotland that's even in ruins or anything now. Fort William is historical. There are places kind of around the area, as you say, that descriptions of each kind of put together could make for something like Wentworth.
I think so, yes. I mean, I've done a little bit of research into it as well, and I've not been able to find anything by the name of Wentworth. So I think, you know, the description of it is quite accurate, but there was no actual Wentworth, but there certainly were places like Wentworth.
If it's something that's truly old, even in the book, then... likely it was built by Scots. If it was a castle at some point in the book. it was likely built by, as you said, some rich lord or some nobleman.
I think so. I mean, you're absolutely right in saying that places that existed for quite a few, hundreds of years would have been appropriated by Cromwell's army in the 1650s and 60s first, and then by the Hanoverian troops during the Jacobite rebellions. Places like Blackness Castle, for instance, which were built by Scots for the purpose of defending against the English, were occupied by English forces and then used as prisons, mostly for political enemies and local rebels. So that kind of thing happened all the time. And one of the things about the Highlands is that there are quite a few castles whose trace has been all but lost because they've been demolished through successive waves of invasion and occupation, and simply out of neglect as well. So quite a few of these places don't exist now, but they would have been living, breathing structures only 250, 300 years ago, which is pretty well precisely around the time that we're going back to with Outlander.
That's why we have you back. I'm glad you chose this chapter well. So he's on the horse. He can reach the pistol. And they ride by the castle / fortress / prison. Yeah.
Wentworth.
The nasty
and
place.
The main, and they're on the main road. She says the main road, it's going to be busy any and every time of day and night because it's like a main thoroughfare. But they did do some planning. They timed it so that it would be during about the midday meal, so soldiers would be likely in a tavern or at the prison or something having a meal, their midday meal. So at least they would have, hopefully, lower the chances of being flooded by redcoats.
Hopefully there'd be minimal soldiers on the road.
So when they stopped to rest the horses a little bit, off the road in some pine, under some pine, a pine grove, I think she says. And Claire asks Jamie how he feels. And I'm already getting googly because this is another line that I hope they keep and it makes me laugh. He says, "I've been trying to decide which hurts worse, my ribs, my hand, or my arse. Trying to choose among them keeps my mind off my back."
I know, but it's so like typical of this character that he's like, he's got his humor even when he's been like beaten half to death and raped. But I mean, even in the face of all that, he still has this like wry, sardonic humor, which I just love.
And that's something that, you know, I've come into contact with quite a bit, actually, in my travels in Scotland. There is an absolutely sort of self-deprecating sense of humor which just flies in the face of some pretty grim situations. I think there's something about the hardiness of the land here that just breeds a different sort of character, you know. And I think when you're faced with a situation like what they would have been faced with in a place as bleak as that, under circumstances where they're very much the underdogs fighting against what seem like impossible odds, you know what, if you can't laugh at it, you might as well give up. And I think that's pretty much what they're doing at this point.
So even though he's in pain and he's, you know, bandaged up to heck, so far they haven't come across any, there has been no conflict in this chapter. And here we go. So they come across four redcoats at the top of a slope. And they realize really quickly that there's no way to get out of it. They've been spotted. Or the redcoats say that they are told to stop all parties on the road due to several escaped prisoners, plural. So Claire kind of has, I can imagine her internally being a little bit smug that more than one had escaped. She was happy that she, well, first of all, probably because, number one, they escaped. But number two,
big bunch of them go she was looking for him.
Yes. But purpose for that, that's one reason. But also because there was more than one prisoner to look for, which means the redcoats had to go in many directions and split up, not just because Jamie could be in any place, but because there was a lot more prisoners than one.
Well, and also, you have to remember that Randall at this point is presumed dead.
By Jamie and company. Yes.
So as far as they're concerned, Jamie is not as high of a priority of a prisoner for anyone but Randall. Randall's the one who took a particular fascination.
Well, that's true, but
I agree, he is an escaped prisoner, but I think that with the bulk of prisoners that did escape, that him by himself is not the one that they're chiefly looking for.
Perhaps not. She was in the part of the prison because she knew she had to look in a certain place where Jamie was being held.
Correct.
That was where people who had maybe not committed capital offenses, but people were, if not all condemned to hang, they were definitely the more important or high priority, high profile, if you will, prisoners were in that section. So likely he was being held before he was taken by Randall in this space with other people who were also condemned to die. So Murta tries to cover for Jamie, who won't reply because the soldiers would definitely recognize his voice, but also because he realizes that there is blood dripping onto the white snow beneath his horse. And Murta, good guy as he is, he engages the soldiers to take their attention to him and ask them for directions. And I think they even go, like, to the top of the slope or something.
He walks them away.
He walks them away a little bit to, like, point and look off into the distance. And Claire, as soon as she has a little bit of a chance, she gets off of her horse, kicks snow over the blood to cover it up. And I'm like, oh, my. It's like, what else can go wrong? You're almost so close, and then you got the soldiers, and then they may have been able to talk themselves out of it. They may have been able to. Like, be safe. There's soldiers around, et cetera, et cetera. But then if that blood had been seen, it was over with. It was over with.
Well, I just would have started a lot more questions.
Oh, yeah.
Led to
that's what I mean. So
an altercation.
What may, like, very small percent chance of maybe going through was now very little to any. And so she covers up the blood, and she pulls off part of her petticoat and, I guess, makes a makeshift bandage with it or wraps it all together and shoves it under his thigh, where I'm guessing the blood is coming from. She's not gentle about it at all. He makes a moan or a noise or something, but she's like, I don't give a crap. We're not going to get killed here. We're not going to get taken. And then she gets back to her horse and just in time. And so when they see her, she appears to be fiddling with something on her horse. And when a redcoat asks her, why didn't the man help you with that? She says, oh, my husband, you know, he's not that well. And that interests the redcoat. And they start to go toward Jamie. He tells him to take his hat off. And what I found fun, not funny, but what I found shocking was not the action that actually happened, but how quickly it happened. I didn't remember, again, it's like surprises me every time. I know that these redcoats are, in the end, they're all gone. But, and I knew that Jamie shot one, but it's like Jamie doesn't even try to reply. It's just like, you there, take your hat off. Boom.
Well, he knows, but he knows that if they see his face
or his hair
or his hair or listen to him talk, that it's done anyway.
Yeah.
But this scene always reminds me a little bit of Indiana Jones. The first Indiana Jones where the guy comes out with a whip and he's doing, no, the swords, the fancy little sword dance. And they're across the field and Indiana Jones just takes his gun out and shoots him. And they actually cut that. In the future ones, so they made it so that it didn't look like it was
unfair.
They thought it was kind of like an over, like a little overkill.
Oh,
he just shot him. So they made it look like the other guy like tried to shoot him first or something like that. They did change the edit, re-edited it.
It is funny though.
Yeah, but it was funny, but they also thought it was kind of out of character for Indiana Jones.
So Jamie just shoots him straight through the cloak, through his cloak, and Murta, we find, has two pistols. He shoots one. Or one shot misses, I think hits a tree or something, but the other shot hits a soldier on the arm. So we have one wounded soldier, one dead soldier, two left. And the one who's wounded is trying to get to his bayonet, I think it said. And one of the unwounded ones stays, but one of the unwounded ones takes off. And Jamie yells at Claire, Claire, go catch up with him, go get him, basically take care of him.
Stop him.
Stop him. So Claire takes off after the soldier. Somewhat catching up to him, not quite enough. She just does what she has to do. She gets off of her horse and braces her arm. And so she shoots and she hits the horse and the horse goes down. And she thinks the soldier was injured. And then as she gets near him, she realizes that the horse stumbles away. I don't know why it surprises me, but I'm following along in Diana's chapter. And Claire's internalization or whatever thoughts at that moment are, I don't know why I didn't think of it before, but I'm ad-libbing here, those are my words, but the sentiment is the same, but I realized that I could not let this man live. She's like, I don't know what I was doing, I was going after him, I don't think where this was leading, but there's only one way this is going to end.
Well, when you think about it, shooting the horse was actually, I know it was not intentional,
yes,
but
it's
actually the quickest way to stop him.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you shot him, and you didn't hit him, and you didn't get him dead, you didn't kill him with that shot, and that horse kept going, He could still escape and live on to tell the tale of the day that, you know, Jamie escaped. But if she shoots the horse, he's at least stopped and he's slowed down, mm-hmm. even if she didn't hit him. So
yeah, and she's still got her horse, so she'd be able to catch him no problem. And exactly. I mean, in warfare, a lot of times, particularly medieval warfare, so a few hundred years, you know, before Outlander, but still, the idea was to try to bring a mounted rider down off of their mount before you finished him off, because they're an incredibly hard target when they're up on top of a horse. So if you can take that advantage away from them, all of a sudden you really evened up the odds. And this, for me, is actually a really important moment in Claire's development and her acceptance of her circumstances. You know, as you say, she was pursuing this redcoat, and I don't think she really realized the consequences of her pursuit. She knew she had to chase after her.
Yeah, they're not playing tag.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Wentworth Prison, I think it said, is within a mile at this point. So it's do or die at this point. And when she approaches the redcoat and she realizes that he's only, 16, I believe, just a boy, it said that you can still see the round features in his face. Her instinct, as someone who has dealt with many dying men and young men, nearly boys before, you know, as a result of the war in the 20th century, is to care for this person, you know, to do the opposite of what she set out to do. So it's a really significant moment from my perspective when she goes against those instincts and almost uses her charm a little bit, you know, that sort of softness that comes with being a carer and being the kind of person that deals with people at the end of their lives in very vulnerable situations. Because she says that, you know, the boy looks up to her almost hopeful, you know, without fear. And she knows you can't let him live. She doesn't quite have the stomach to cut his throat. So she does the tactic that that Murta taught her, you know, bends his head forward and puts her dagger right in the back of his neck. And that finishes him off quite quickly. Nonetheless, though, she's just had to do a pretty brutal thing. And so I think this really for her is a point of no return. She's really accepted the fact that she's living in a different era. It is life or death, and that some of the values that she's had previously have to go aside here, because this is a matter of survival. If she doesn't do this, all hell is going to be coming down on them, and that just can't happen. So we see a little side of Claire here that I think we've not caught as significant a glimpse of until this moment.
I agree. I think it also was made easier for her that his horse had rolled on him. So he had had internal injuries. Yeah. So he was not going to make it anyway. So she almost saw it more as a mercy killing.
I think so, yeah. She did mention that, you know, she thought he might not make it anyway, but she couldn't take that chance.
This is, to me, I agree with you, the epitome of her not going back. The Stones was the first one. That's her decision. But here, she's not killing someone because it's kill or be killed, although in the end it kind of is. But right now, her life is not threatened at this moment.
Right.
She is choosing, it's not self-defense. It is complete, and it's hard to say because we love these characters. It is murder. It quite frankly is. It is definitely to save them. It has a higher purpose, but it is, I don't know about cold-blooded, but it is definitely calculated. It is out of need and out of fear and out of survival. But considering the TV series, I think as you hit upon, her entire training, her entire life, everything in the war is supposed to put people back together. She was supposed to help them mend or be there as they were dying to help them, to help ease their fears, if you will. But it was definitely in the positive sense of making people better or trying to make things more comfortable. And here she is. It's a 180. He was going to die likely anyway. So you could say there's a shade of mercy killing here. But I can just imagine in the series. Again, I do this because I think about all these juxtapositions, Claire as healer and Claire as defender of her family. And right now that family is Jamie and Murta. But as defender of all of them and protector, this is Claire is protector. Claire is she is at this moment a Boudica, Borussia.
It depends on the pronunciation. The sort of Victorian pronunciation tends to be Boudica, but Borussia is a perfectly acceptable way of doing it as well. It's tomato, tomato, really.
There you go. So this, I can see them in that doing, of course, the scene, and then maybe the decision, I think, is heartbreaking, and she has to do it quickly, but I think it's going to take a few moments. I think they're going to milk it a tiny bit. I hope they do. Because then they can show her, or you know, her grief in her mind, how she was in war, covered in blood, but helping, trying to save lives, and here she is taking one. And it could be of the same type of older child, young man, that she helped save on the front.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for a direct contrast there, whether they would choose to flash sort of back and forth between a scene of her in the hospital, for instance, as you say, putting people back together, and then going back to her quite, you know, literally taking someone apart. It's going to be quite a powerful scene nonetheless. I think she's going to be quite torn up on the inside, but it would be an opportunity to show Claire really stealing herself. I think it's going to be a bit more just matter of fact than we might expect. Because as you say, I think this is an important point where she is accepting, you know, this new world that she's in. Does she like it? No. But is she having to come to terms with it? Absolutely. So I think she's going to do this in a rather businesslike way, which is the way it comes across in the book. I mean, it does say that, you know, she's a little taken aback by how innocent he appears to be, but there's not many words given over to her grieving over him or lamenting exactly the fact that she's having to do this. This is, as I said before, do or die, not in the immediate sense of this boy is going to kill me if I don't kill him. But there's more at stake, her family, her life with Jamie. And that for her is enough to put her over the edge to make that 180.
They basically flash straight to the boat. The boat was called the Cristabel. Cristabel. It depends on if it's a French name or if it's an English name.
Well, it is bound for...
Yeah, but going back and forth, it can be an English boat or a French boat. Mm. Well, actually, it was from Scotland, so Scottish or a French boat. So Myrta says, we'll hope for a smooth crossing. If not, we'll likely get there with a corpse on our hands. And Claire finds it inconceivable that Jamie suffers from such terrible seasickness. She says, seasick? Scotsmen aren't seasick. And Myrta replies, then mayhap he's a red-heated Hottentot. All I know is he's green as a rotten fish and puking his guts out. Now, I did look it up. I usually do look these things up, but I thought we'd ask you. Do you know what a Hottentot is?
Yeah, actually. It's a bit of a derogatory term, actually.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's used in reference to the Khoikhoi people in South Africa. And they were encountered by the Dutch when the Dutch were doing a lot of their colonizing around Africa and in Southeast Asia and the Indies. And it's a tribe in South Africa, and they're landlocked. They don't have any experience of seafaring. So when he says, you know, he may be a redhead and Hottentot, he's really just implying that, you know, yeah, he may be a Scot with the ginger hair, but, you know, in terms of his sea legs, like he's never left the land. And poor Jamie does seem to be in even more stress here. I mean, the guy just doesn't catch a break near the end of the book, does he?
Being seasick in this situation could actually kill him.
Right.
if he dislodges, you know, a broken rib comes apart in any way and perforates a lung. I mean, it's dangerous to vomit.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's such a big guy, so he's so strong.
Dude, I don't even like vomiting when I'm not, injured. I mean, if you work out, like, really hard at the gym and your abs are sore, I mean, I don't even want to. The idea of, like, being sick at that point makes my, like, stomach turn, because that would hurt. But I can't imagine having, like, broken ribs.
Injuries in that,
and injuries and bleeding from places.
I've been car sick. I never thought I would be seasick. I've been on the ocean a number of times in small vessels. But I will say that in the 90s, quite a number of years ago, a friend and I were traveling through Europe. And we were on a ferry, it was an overnight ferry, from Brindisi, Italy, to Corfu in Greece. And, you know, you're like, oh, well, it's just overnight. Everyone just sleeps. You wake up and you're there. Oh, my gosh, I was sick. I never thought I would be seasick, ever. And it's something that until you're on truly the open, there's nothing around you, see, you may not find that out. And so I was shocked to learn, because even now going on the ocean, I don't get seasick. But on that time I was, and that is the only type of, probably the largest crossing I still have done.
You don't find out until it's too late.
Well, exactly. And I'll put it this way, a lot of other people were too.
Oh, yeah.
Regarding using the boat, Jamie knew he wouldn't make it overland long enough in his condition to escape from people. I mean, he may physically stay alive long enough.
It would put everybody else in more danger.
Yes.
Yeah.
To be on land.
And yeah, they couldn't travel as fast as they needed to get somewhere safe, wherever that place was, and it didn't really exist.
They're a lot harder to track when they're in a boat heading off somewhere else. Mm-hmm. If they're on land, they're much easier to find.
Myrta says he, meaning Jamie, things he'll kill himself only, and no one else will be hurt. Whereas if they are on land and he dies, the others are at risk because they're around him and they're stuck and it's taking them longer to travel. She says to Jamie later, "Congratulations, I believe you're going to make medical history by being the only documented person ever actually to die of seasickness." And with our lovely one-liners, or our lovely Jamie-isms, he says, "Oh good, I'd hate to think it was all a waste." I just love it that he's literally been through crap. And every single part of his body, internally, externally, hurts. And he's been tortured and abused.
Still cracking jokes.
And he's still joking out of half of a face that's half swollen. I mean, Jamie is actually... Oh, they were talking about the danger of seasickness. Not necessarily dangerous in and of itself, but she does remark that Jamie's actually bringing up blood now when he's vomiting. So whether it's one of the ribs or just the stomach raw from vomiting, she says it's not a good sign. And the whole thing is the strain on his heart. So at that, Myrta quietly says, "He's a heart like a lion and a head like an ox." And then he asks her for the laudanum and he says, "We're going to get this in him." And he and Claire help each other hold Jamie. And he says, I had to do this line too. He says to Jamie, "Swallow this, me bonnie wee dormouse, or I'll break your neck. And forby, he'll keep it down, too. I'm going to hold shut your nose and your mouth. If you bring it up, it's coming out your ears." Oh, gosh. I really, really... I never hated Myrta, but since about Lallybroch time, especially... And then after that...
Because he starts to actually have a personality.
They show us more of him, yeah.
Like, before then, he's just the quiet...
Ape-like.
Yeah.
Like, she calls him monkey-like.
Friend and countryman of Jamie. But, yeah. But once you hit Lallybroch and you see him interact with Jenny and then on the search, yeah, I think that he opens up more to her so absolutely. That they become more close-knit companions. So I think that they're letting their walls down to each other. So he's allowing her to see more of him as a person, which is...
And they get enough into Jamie that he falls into his drug-induced sleep. And when they get to France, he is carried on a board by two monks into the Abbey of Sainte-Anne de Beaupré. So that is chapter 37. That is, wow. I mean, that's if you talk about action, especially action to length of chapter ratio,
right?
That is action. I don't know if we get more action packed than that.
Good things come in small packages, right?
Right. That's absolutely correct.
And in terms of the title of the chapter as well, Escape. I mean, as you say, there have been several escapes at this point, you know, up to and including getting away from Macranix and making for the coast to go to France. This, you know, for me is perhaps the largest escape of them all. I mean, obviously the one from Wentworth Prison was very dramatic and essential for the story to move forward, because if Jamie hadn't been broken out of there, he would have been killed. But this is now... a leap into a whole new uncertain future for Claire as well as for Jamie, because now they're leaving the one home that Jamie's known. I mean, he did campaigning in France and the Low Countries as well when he was part of the French army. But now they don't have a home per se to go to. Jamie's got a relative at the Abbey, but that's it. So they're escaping from Scotland, from a life that they've become accustomed to, into a very certain future. They have no idea if they'll ever be able to return to Scotland or not. For all they know, it's the last time that they'll have seen its shores. So this is quite a grand escape, really, one that is sending them into a very uncertain situation, not quite as immediately dangerous as the one they were in before. But as we come to learn in the second book, one that perhaps isn't any less threatening to their well-being either in the grand scheme of things.
No, it's definitely escape on a much larger scale than we've seen so far. Like, there have been a lot of escapes, not even just since Wentworth Prison. Like, they've been escaping since the book started.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an escape of some kind in almost every chapter. But I think this is probably the largest scale escape that they've done so far.
This is international now.
Right.
I mean, they've crossed borders, and yeah, now they are actually, and I know we're not quite at the end of the book, though we're very close. The Outlander, which was Claire, is now, even though he's been there, it's now, well, I think Claire and Jamie, Myrta too, it's become... almost by this point, Outlanders, because it's setting the scene for getting ready for book 2.
Yeah, very much so. Good way to put it.
And hopefully season two. Oh my goodness. Yes, we have high hopes, but of course no words from anyone on any official level or announcement. But we are as excited as anyone.
I think judging from the enthusiasm and passion of Outlander fans up till now, I mean, seeing how active, I was about to say we, but I would now at this point say, or I was about to say they rather, I would now say we, counting myself among them. I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to be going for more than one season. I mean, it's an incredibly active fan audience. I've not really seen anything like it before in a build-up to something like this. It's got as much love going for it as series do that have been running for years and years, and it's not even started yet. I mean, yes, we've got the books to go off of, but, you know, if the strength of that series and the loyalty that it inspires is any indication, I think those hopes for a second series aren't going to go in vain.
Well, I know that it's on a slightly different scale, and obviously it was years ago, so it's like probably a decade ago at this point. So the time period was also key. But, like, I know there was a big build-up to, like, the Lord of the Rings trilogy when they were filming that into a movie.
Oh, yeah.
But even that doesn't come close to what I've been experiencing with the Outlander build-up.
Well, you also have to...
And those books have been out for a while.
Mm-hmm. Since, like,
But they didn't have social media the way that we do now.
I understand that. So it is a different world. But you also have to say, even though it's, you know, different from the lead-up to Lord of the Rings build-up, because that took quite a few years to film as well.
Film? I mean, because they filmed them all at once.
Yes. So it definitely took time, so there was a lot of interest and coverage. Something similar to what's going on now, to some extent. However, yes, they had fans, probably many millions of more fans than have ever read these books, definitely, because, I mean, that's a classic. People have been, I'm going to use the term even though it may sound odd, people have been hot to trot for Outlander internationally for over 20 years.
Yeah.
So over 20 years. So definitely no comparison to Lord of the Rings as far as length and being a classic and everything. But it is definitely capitalizing on this huge fan base. So, you know, you can have fans of an author, fans of a book or a series. That's going to happen. That can happen anytime, and it happens everywhere. But fans that have their own gather. I've been to fan gatherings. They're very, very small, very limited. People who are somewhat local. And we've gotten together, you know, once or twice a year over the past, you know, number of years. And I certainly have not been to all of them. There are so many regional groups that have been doing this for over 10 years before Starz ever came into this. And also, I would say, Summer, when you said this is the biggest thing that you've seen or you've been involved with, well, neither of us has ever been involved with anything. So you can't say that this is like anything before.
No. Okay, not to the degree that we are obviously involved now. We haven't done podcasts for other series. That's not what I'm saying. But even shows that I've been interested in that I know that they're making
you don't
into
follow
things,
it much.
I haven't followed it like
that's
I followed
fair.
This.
Not even
and
a little bit.
That's the thing. I say it every time, and it's probably sick of me saying it. Follow what? There's no show yet. That's the whole point. I think that's what they're saying, right? There's this huge love and this and that and passion, and the show doesn't even exist. It's not even started yet. And I joked about it last August when we started the podcast that we're going to be the first podcast about a show that doesn't exist yet, but it shows the passion and the fans, and I agree with you. I would include you in the we as well.
It's an honorable distinction to be included. But, I mean, you see this kind of build-up, or not even build-up, rather, this sort of fan dedication for shows that are already out there. I mean, you think of things like Arrested Development, which have a quite sort of, you know, cult-like following. But because they've been going for years and years, I mean, Outlander's not even started yet. So, as far as I'm aware, quite unprecedented. And I think that's something that all Outlanders should be quite proud of. I mean, this has been a sort of bottom-up move for Outlander, and that's pretty innovative.
It has been, and I think it's been since day one. It really hasn't stopped. When it was announced that they were doing it, it was exciting, but you didn't have any information. I think pretty much everything started with the leak of Sam Heughan being cast. That pretty much started the huge boom in what I would consider Outlander watch. So, yeah, it's definitely, to my definitely uneducated in the entertainment world view, definitely unprecedented. But it's just been a thrill and a roller coaster and so much fun thus far. And we look forward to, knock on wood, many more years, hopefully. Many more series. Well, thank you again, and hopefully again in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. That will wrap, I think, Chapter 37 for our read-along. And we
look forward to having you back to talk about maybe discuss an episode. But also, once your book gets further or you've had some more things published, please let us know. Come back anytime.
That would be absolutely fantastic. I get tingles all over just thinking about being able to chat about an actual episode.
Oh my gosh, stop it. Okay, so we're going to call it. Thank you, Dave, so much. It was a joy and a pleasure, and we cannot wait until this thing starts.
Thank you. It's been an absolute delight.
And that wraps up our read-along for Chapter 37. Please join us back next week when we will discuss Chapter 38, entitled The Abbey. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com. I dreamt it last night that my